Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk radio show. My guest this morning is novelist Joshua Breath. His latest novel is titled Peep Show. It is a story about a young man torn between a mother who is trying to erase the past and a father struggling to maintain his dignity in a less-than-savory business. Joshua and I will be discussing Peep Show and his life's journey. Good morning, Joshua. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. I enjoyed reading your book. Story is a very interesting one. It was wonderfully written. It just sort of gave me the idea about, you know, you can do so much writing and you can base things on family and relationships, and that's what I like about it. And let us get started with having you tell us a little bit more about yourself. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, from childhood. I grew up in New Jersey, in South Orange, New Jersey, which is northern, and about a 20-minute drive without traffic to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I mentioned that because having New York so close to me, and having parents who were interested in theater and film, we were exposed a great deal to theater, and I also think that coming from New Jersey is a great place to come as an artist, partly because I went to a very large, diverse high school, and sometimes people say to me, "What is it about New Jersey and our writers and actors and musicians coming from there?" And it may be the proximity to New York, and it may be just the fact that it's a really good life lesson to grow up around so many people of different ethnic and economic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated in 1986 from Columbia High School, which is in Maplewood, New Jersey, and I spent a year in Japan teaching. I read that you could take your BS, your diploma, and go over to Japan and make some money teaching English as a second language, and I sort of went over there with no job and ended up living in Tokyo with a really good job and just out of school. It was a great life lesson for me. I remember thinking about taking writing more seriously there as I was keeping a journal of my time, and I started to write creatively. I had always written creative stories, but I never thought about publishing, and I think it was in Japan that I started to write things that were humorous and there was story involved. And when I came back a year later, I was living in Manhattan for a year, and it's there that I decided to take classes. I wanted to go to the New School in Manhattan and study fiction. I found myself wanting to write the kind of stories I read, which was, I remember reading Ethan Kanan and Alice Munro and Raymond Carver, and thinking, this is what I want to do. I want to write about the human condition, about relationships, and I started to sort of get very excited about it. And that's what I did. I took some classes, and I found a mentor, and ultimately, as I was writing and handing things in to this class and this man, he said, perhaps you'd like to get a Master's of Fine Arts, an MFA graduate program. They give MFAs in all the art forms. And I found myself applying to schools, and I ended up in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, a school called St. Mary's College. And Ethan Kanan, who I mentioned, was teaching there. That was one of the draws. And I found myself able to publish in national literary magazines. There are a bunch of these magazines that help writers get seen and help writers get bylines, and ultimately, I was told if you published in three national lit mags, you would get an agent. And so I did. I published in three, and then everybody said, well, it's time to write a novel now that you have all these short stories. people don't publish short stories first. They publish novels, establish themselves as authors, and then come out with their collections. Although Ethan Kanan and a woman named Pam Houston, who were my teachers, both had collections come out first. Mm-hmm. There's always exceptions, but as soon as these agents were aware that I was a decent enough writer to publish in the Lit Mags, they said, where's your novel? So I wrote a first one, which did not and has not published. But I guess it was a great lesson in novel writing and the journey of that, the stacking of chapters and, you know, just the accomplishment of writing a last sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent it out to about 10 places. We were looking in New York, where the industry is sort of the mecca of the industry, although there are major publishing houses in Boston and London and not a whole lot else, but New York's really the place. And we shopped it around, and it came back, and my agent said, let's do this to it, and let's tweak it here, and let's see what we can do. And right around that time, I read a book by an author named Dave Eggers. And he wrote a book called A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. And the way it moved and sort of the rules he was breaking grammatically and just letting it all fly, and a lot of the dialogue was sort of what we call ping pong. It was just very mm-hmm. much back and forth. One word, how are you? What do you mean, how am I? I said, I asked you nicely. No, you didn't. You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I got sort of inspired, and I went with a clean canvas, and I wrote a book called The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Greene, which I used some of my personal life to dig deep and to get that book going, and I wrote a little bit about my family, but then I took license, and that's the beauty of fiction. You can turn right. If the truth was left, you can turn right or go straight, and I did a lot of that. And when I was done, I had 2-3 offers from publishing houses, and it took me 2 years to write that book, and the reviews were very, very good, and we sold a bunch of them. And mm-hmm. in my industry, that's how you get the opportunity to write another book, is to mm-hmm. have success, reviews, attention. And my publisher, Algonquin, was excited to work with me again. And so I went and wrote a book called Peep Show. Peep Show is about a family from suburban New Jersey in the 70s. And they have 2 things going on in their lives that are very unusual. One is that the father has continued the theater that his father ran in Times Square, New York. And to keep up with the Joneses, they have turned it into a peep show house, which it used to be earlier when his dad ran it, just a very beautiful theater that showed first-run movies like The Grapes of Wrath in its day, and people would come dressed, you know, for a Saturday night and walk in with white gloves up to their elbows, and it was all like that. In time, Times Square became famously smutty, and those theaters were not detonated, but just became smut houses, places where people came to see stag films, pre-Betamax, pre-VCR. And the father in this family, he's a little bit like a Willy Loman in a sense, in that he doesn't want to keep up with the Joneses. He's disgusted by what's happening, but this is his livelihood. Mm-hmm. So he moves forward with it. It ages him. And at home in the suburbs, our protagonist is a 17-year-old boy who's trying to figure out what he's going to do as high school ends. And his father's saying, come with me, come work with me. And his mother, who has a history in Times Square, but we don't know much about that. She's younger than Dad. Mm-hmm. She's trying to erase her entire past. And the book begins with her attempt to do that by converting, in a sense, from non-practicing Jewish person to a very severe sect of Judaism called Hasidism. In Judaism, we have tiers, as it were. There's mm-hmm. people who just go to the holidays twice a year. They're Reform or maybe conservative. And then you go up to Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, there's something called ultra-Orthodox. And then there's Hasidic life. If you've ever seen people in Manhattan or other cities wearing the black hat, sometimes they have payas.
Yeah.
Curly hair from their ears.
Yes.
The sect that I was writing about was a fictional one that I sort of took as a hybrid of other sects. And there was a great deal of research in that and understanding who they are and how they think and how they live their lives. And so you've got these two worlds, this peep show world where the women are wearing wigs and getting on stage and exposing themselves, and then you've got the Hasidic world where women are wearing wigs because this is, at 18 years old or 19, you want to get married, and it's an arranged marriage within your sect of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the women immediately purchase a very, very expensive wig made of human hair to cover their own hair, which is, in a sense, too modest to, or too vulnerable or sexual to be showing to people on the streets. These people live their lives according to certain laws, and
mm-hmm.
The laws have been evolved from the Bible and Talmud from rabbis over the centuries. And it's, in a sense, the idea is to stay away from secular life completely.
Mm-hmm.
Novels, movies, wearing shorts in the summer, bathing suits, you know,
mm-hmm.
where women are not to look in the eyes or touch a male until their wedding day. And the boys, if you're walking down the street and you see a girl, it's best to look the other way. So there's a great deal in these laws that are concerned with boys and girls and men and girls, and there's pages and pages on menstruation. There's pages and pages on men and when it's okay to ejaculate and not. I don't know if that's an appropriate
mm-hmm.
word for blog radio. and so it's very, very serious stuff. And I personally will tell you, I am not throwing punches at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although I find religion fascinating in novels because there's so much power in it. There's so much thought and conversation about it. For some it means nothing, for some it means everything. But I'm a to each his own kind of person, and I feel that my character, the one who converts to this severe sect,
mm-hmm.
is only bettering herself. As an adult, she's made the decision to find herself in a more ritualized lifestyle, and this is helping her erase perhaps some of the memories, some of the decisions she made earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And she's moving forward in a powerful way, but in a group way. It's not about being an individual. It's about following the rules and the herd to some extent. So I had an early interview with
mm-hmm.
Haaretz magazine, which is a big
mm-hmm.
deal out of Israel, and the guy said,
yeah.
I saw that you have empathy for her.
Right.
I was really glad to see that, because my attempt was not to make her the buffoon or anybody wearing the black or believing in something the buffoon. The
right.
thought here is this decision was made, and then she grabbed her kids and said, you have to follow me, you have to do this with me, especially her younger daughter. So our protagonist has a younger daughter who drinks the Kool-Aid, as it were, or follows mom into all that this is. And her life will be very much altered as the book progresses. That girl is, there's discussion about that girl being married to someone she doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So our protagonist is saying, well, dad says come be work in the Times Square area to be around me, because he doesn't want me to be a Hasid. And dad's rejecting the whole Hasid thing, and it's creating divorce within the family. And then mom's saying come be with me, which she has done in the past and put him in the black. And he's 17 years old, and he's torn between these two parents, and the book is about his decision, how his decision is made, how he comes to it, and yeah, quite a journey there.
Very interesting book. Like I said at the beginning, the way you wrote it, it's precise, it's concise, you have wonderful conversations in there, and when I read it, I feel like I'm there.
Oh, that's great. That's a good
yeah, one. To be able to connect, and then you can't help yourself but to align yourself with, as you had mentioned, the various characters in the book, because how would you think if you were in that position? And in all actuality, as you had mentioned, there's really no right or wrong,
yeah.
because it's more about a journey and one's spiritual journey that she has decided to take, and now she obviously wants that same success, so to speak, for the rest of her family.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so it's very, very different. Did you do a lot of research prior to writing this novel?
I did. The impetus came from a story I heard about a man who was working, he lived in Long Island, New York, another suburb outside of Manhattan. And he was an Orthodox Jew, and he had five children, and his life was very, very ordinary, except for the fact that he was the peep show king of Times Square. And and so he's a real guy, and and someone I knew was familiar with him, and this was his life. He was the one who brought the ability to put a token into a machine and have the screen rise, and you have a stag film, or you have whatever you have. Sometimes you have a live person behind it. But he brought the films. Modern Orthodox dad from the suburbs of Long Island. So there was a little bit of a Tony Soprano thought there, right? By day, we don't know where he goes, but he comes home and, in a sense, helps his kids with homework. I don't know if Tony ever did.
Right.
So I thought, wow, this is pretty powerful, and I went for it. And it took me a long time to write this book. It took me a great deal of research. I was in Brooklyn, New York, multiple times. Brooklyn would be the mecca of all Hasidic life, which is interesting in the sense that, well, I can give you a little history of how that came to be.
Sure.
We can talk about one sect of Hasidic Judaism called the Lubavitch sect. And so these people, they don't wear the payas, the curly, the men don't wear the curly hair on the side. They wear fedoras. And yarmulkes underneath the fedora, a black fedora. Even at a young age, the kids wear the a fedora that sometimes looks too big for their head. And it's all black garb, and the women wear the shadel. The shadel is the wig that covers their natural hair. And then the women wear skirts down to their ankles and to their wrists. And if you're in Manhattan, you will see these couples, and you'll see the man, and then the woman next to him, you'll see the hair, and that's not her hair. It's interesting. It's a little bit like researching the Amish, or in the sense that they are adhering to the laws of their life by wearing the garb of centuries ago, and that's what these people are doing. They originally came from an area in Eastern Europe called Lubavitch, which would be a small shtetl town in Eastern Europe. And they had a leader, a Rebbe, or so they call him a Rebbe, or the rabbi. Their leader would take them in time because of pogroms and pressure that we all know about for Jews in history, and they would land ultimately in Brooklyn to begin a life that would be distanced from secular life. But meanwhile, they're 15 minutes away on a subway from arguably the most secular place in the world, New York City. So, you know, for me to get to where they were, I took a 15-minute subway train from Union Square right in the middle of Manhattan. I feel like I land on this planet of Crown Heights, Brooklyn. And you have African American life there, and then you have an Asian presence. Brooklyn is very diverse, and then in this corner, and there's various corners in Brooklyn. You will see them and their temple. And in the early 90s, the Rebbe I talked about, their leader or his relatives down the line take over that role. And the last Rebbe that ran the Lubavitcher movement died in the early 90s, so they don't have a leader at this time. Many of them believe that that leader, his name was Menachem Schneerson, they believe that he is the Messiah, and that he will return, and this is a big, big belief of some of theirs. But some of them want you to know, no, I know what dead is. He's not around anymore, and we're moving forward. He's like, some of them hear him, some of us don't. The Lubavitch movement has evolved a great deal in the days since my book took place. And I guess what I would say about them is that they're all over the world now. There's nowhere that you won't find what they call a Chabad house or Lubavitcher presence. And there's nothing negative at all about their ideas of life. They love one another. They take care of each other. They're not that interested in talking to people outside of their world although my father recently told me he has a friend who's Lubavitch, who continues to invite him to his house. They're very, very interested in people thinking about becoming more religious.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my research and being around them, they wanted to know if I would rap to fill in with them. To fill in, for those who don't know, is a symbol of Jewish life, and there are men who strap them onto their arms, and actually there's a in my first novel I sort of describe a little bit of it, but the black leather straps that go around your arm and around one finger 7 times, around another finger 5 times, it has to be precise, and the prayers that are done. The Hasids see this as a mitzvah, as a gift to God. If they get, for example, if they get me to put it on, it's a mitzvah for them. And if I put it on, it's a mitzvah for me, so a gift for God. I am not the most religious person in the world. I come from an upbringing which maybe triggered all of this writing about Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
My upbringing was that I went to a very religious school till the time I was in fourth grade. And my older brother went to the same school. We call it yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I tell groups who don't know it, it's like Catholic school for Jews. you know, you show up, you're wearing the
yoga,
you're I'm praying and the first thing in the morning and bobbing my head and what they call davening. And in the fourth grade, my family moved, and this was sort of the impetus for my first book, The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Green. Two brothers who don't know any other school but this very religious school are plopped into a public school setting.
Mm-hmm.
So you picture all the black garb of my yeshiva life and the talk of biblical stories of mass destruction, which there was a lot of. God had a terrible temper, and then you get plopped into a public school setting, and there's a girl across from me, and she's wearing a pink sweater, and she's got lip gloss on, and what planet am I on? That first book is about those two brothers and their life, and so I have taken my upbringing and those years with me. I have a very strong memory, as a lot of writers do. And I wrote these two books that I'm proud of, and I think I may be moving on from the topic of Judaism. The book I'm working on now is distanced myself from that. I don't necessarily want to be pigeonholed. I wrote Jacob Green, I call it Jacob Green, The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Green, not really knowing that I was writing a Jewish-themed book. I was just writing a book about a Jewish family, and then I was approached by the Jewish Book Council, and they sent me on a big tour of all the Jewish community centers in the country. So all of a sudden, I was being reviewed by the Jewish magazines and visiting JCCs, and I totally embraced it because I had no clue that there were so many people out there who love to read books with Jewish themes or Jewish characters. And as you said, many of your listeners are women. People who read out there are women, and a lot of times it's Jewish women. And another interesting thing that happened with that first novel was there was crossover, because a lot of the things I was writing about, the religion and guilt and the rules, had great crossover for those that went to Catholic school or grew up in Catholic settings.
Mm-hmm.
So I not only found myself in JCCs, but I found myself with non-Jewish groups of women and sometimes a smattering of men discussing their lives as God-fearers and on that side of the tracks.
Well, let me answer this now. What is interesting is that you mentioned about this is a true story in some ways. It sort of inspired you to write the book Pete Cho. And here you have an Orthodox Jew, and who is obviously, I imagine, spend the time reading the Torah and everything else, and obviously, for lack of a better term, he preaches the Torah to the family.
Yeah.
And yet, he is the pioneer of the coin-operated system. And
yeah.
How is that, the balancing act, you know, of those two?
Yes.
What's
well, in Peep Show, his name is Martin, the dad who runs the Peep Show house. He's a major character, and a character I drew from people I know growing up in New Jersey, and he's an interesting guy, and there's been a lot of feedback on him. He's not a very religious person at all, and I think when I first started, the impetus was this guy who was a modern Orthodox Jew who was the Peep Show King. I found that was going to be kind of tricky for me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to pull back a little bit on the sense that, yeah, you know, a guy who is actually opening up prayer books and then heading to a peep show house, I felt like I didn't know if I could drive that. So he's not a religious person. His ex-wife, who he's in contact with because the family's, he comes to the house and there's a great deal of scenes with all of them. His wife is the one who's become extremely religious, and even when he was married to her, they didn't practice Judaism. But like any major life change, she, the wife, has erased everything and has rebuilt herself completely. So he is finding hypocrisy in that. She's saying to him, if the people in my life find out that you own a peep show theater, they're going to shun me. And not only are they going to shun me, they're going to shun our kids and my daughter, our daughter, and because we're not sure where the boy is going at this point. But, and also, she will not be able to marry again. And this is a very true thing. If it were heard in the community that she had been married to this guy who is in the smut business, the opinion of this from the Lubavitcher community would be very, very strong. And she would have a lot of trouble continuing in their milieu, which is very, very communal.
Right.
So he's not a religious person. He's more of just a guy who wants to live the rest of his life and have a good rhythm to it and be in love and have his son near him. He loves his daughter, but he can't get near her because she's completely wrapped up in mom's new world. So, when you take on a fiction, you have to be careful about offending people. And I've survived both books. I haven't really offended anybody. The only people I've offended are people who read pieces of the book. They read pieces of the book in interviews, in newspapers, and they see things out of context. And I only had a couple of letters like that. So my intention when I write a book is not to stir or upset. It's mostly about creating characters with dimension that come right out of real life, and the way you create characters and then have them interact, and those relationships, in a sense, tell the story and move the story along.
You did a very good job with that, though.
Thank you.
The first thing that I got from, like, oh my gosh, I'm doing a show on Peep Show.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, let's see.
What's it going to be like, right?
Right. What is it going to be like? And as I read the book from beginning to the end, I look at the underlying current that is all about family life, about relationships. That could easily happen to any family. It has got nothing to do whether it's from a Jewish family, a Buddhist family, or a Christian family, or a Muslim family. It can happen to anyone because it's...
This story would apply. It could fit all of those. That's true.
Precisely. To me, that's the powerful message. It's about missed opportunities or creating opportunities. There's so many opportunities out there that we can capitalize on in building family relationships.
Right. Sort of tragic in the sense that certainly mom loves her son and wants him to be a part of her life, and she says that in the book. But the power of what it is that she's found in this sect is actually powerful enough to have her considering distancing herself from her son. So that there's no reason that a story couldn't be told if that was in another religion. So that's a good point.
And of course, at the same time, there's a reason for what she did. That's what I got from it, because it's not something like, you know, hey, you got to take care of your dad.
Right.
Your dad needs you more than I need you as of right now.
Right.
No telling what's going to happen down the road, but certainly as of right now, this is the situation, so we have to make sort of a rational decision here, so to speak.
Right.
So in writing a novel, just any general novel, I mean, you've written two obviously very successful novels. Do you have a ending in mind before you get started on how it would flow?
I do not. Obviously, you talk to a bunch of authors and they all have different thoughts. There's the notion of outlining the entire novel and then knowing where it lands. And I have not done that. After writing Peep Show, that sounds amazing. And the conversations I'm having with my editor, I think we may be doing some more outlining than I have in the past. Although Peep Show did have more of a plot than The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Green, in the sense that with Jacob Green, I just began on page one and allowed it to just flow. There was no promise of publication, which was daunting. And I was spending a great deal of time on it, but I just sort of had all my eggs in that basket, and I just sort of let it rip. And that's the advice I would give to people starting out. And to not worry about titles on day one, and to not worry about last sentences on day one. But some writers head out into the desert with a couple of characters and a notion of what they might say to themselves, and others are completely outlined with the ending. I have not had any clue of my ending, even halfway through with Jacob Green. So what that does is it creates panic, you know, and you're like, oh, I got to go figure it out. And when you have to go figure it out, it will come. And my editor always says there's only one ending, there's only one right ending. And sometimes we're there, there's five, and, you know, it's like, well, we can
do
that. But I think she's right. You need to get closest to that one right ending.
Do you find yourself writing some of your personal experiences, even though it is a fiction in a way?
Yeah.
Based on your own personal experience in your work that you do?
Yes. I definitely draw from my own truth and my life. And as a writer, I'm a listener of. You know, if I'm on the train and someone's behind me, a lot of times that conversation could find its way into something I'm working on, because I'm very big on the way people actually talk, and that's why I receive kudos for dialogue. In the sense, is that wow, it's actually two people talking, almost as if I am hearing them, and that's always been very, very effective in creating characters and creating pace and creating story. As I mentioned, I went to yeshiva, and I grew up in a family that would ultimately split when I was about 13, and that all was in The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Green, the dysfunction of that some of the dysfunction that was very, very true in my own life. And but I masked some of it, and I turned right here, and there's characters that didn't exist in that book, but that would be the one that I drew most from my own truth. Peep Show, in the textures of it, I drew from my own truth. I went to New York University in I graduated in 91, so in like 89 I lived for a year in Hell's Kitchen in 43rd and 10th Street, right next to what the Times Square that I'm talking about in Peep Show, which, by the way, is very, very inviting and cleaned up and Disney-fied. Some people call it Rudolph Giuliani-fied. Giuliani came into New York while I was there, and it's like it took a few months, but there weren't any. He got rid of the homeless people, which I have no idea where he put them. Still don't. And there were it was a rough time, end of 80s, early 90s. Lots of guns and lots of homeless, and it was edgy, which it had always been, and there was a certain amount of character to that, but I got real tired of it, and I just up and left. And as soon as I left, Giuliani moved in, and now the New York you visit is, it's like a great European city. It's like there's babies and strollers and parks and sun, and Times Square's got giant M&Ms in the air, It's a whole new world. So, but my time there, it had not yet evolved, and it was very, very New York. But they kept saying, "Yep, the neighborhood's up and coming." And then I'd go home, and there'd be a prostitute in my vestibule.
It is up and coming.
Yeah,
changing.
Yeah, not quite yet, but we're almost there. She's like, "Okay, honey, you can walk by me," and you know, right near the Holland Tunnel, and lots of interesting action going on there. I'm a pretty big person, so I would leave. I say that because I never had any trouble. There were some creepy folks, but I would always walk from the subway, you know, and with my shoulders back. Like, I never had any problem, thank God. And I, why did I live over there? Why did my parents let me live over there? Because I had been in the dorms, and I was just dying to have my own bedroom. So So I didn't care. I just took my own cheap place and the five floor walk up, and in time I would learn that I was absorbing a lot of the textures of that area. You know, the eye contact with the people on the streets, the presence of prostitutes, the rampant use of really scary drugs, and and then the blinking peep show lights.
Right.
So in that sense, I did take some truth, and I also researched Times Square of that time and read some really detailed books. And yeah, I had these two balls in the air: this world of Hasidic life, and then this world of peep show life. And it ended up being quite a plate of stuff. But I'm proud of Peep Show.
You did a wonderful job, and I believe what you just said makes a whole lot of sense, because a lot of times, you can read about it, you can interview someone about it, it's never quite the same unless you have the opportunity to experience it yourself. So now it makes sense when I read Peep Show, I could sense the fact that, the author is there.
Yeah.
David is experiencing all this thing, rather than a second-hand information, so to speak.
Right, yeah.
And so, needless to say, whole and behold, you never knew it back then that you'll be writing something about what you experienced a few years back into your new novel. And that's the fascinating part about it, because to me, that's life is a journey.
Yes.
You never know, and you have to be in the present moment and experience it. We're not talking about right or wrong here. We're just talking about being in the present moment, because every moment that you're passing by that you are currently experiencing is a memorable experience. Whether it's right or wrong, it's irrelevant here. And so you never know when you can use that for future references.
Right, whether it's fiction or not, and or whether it's creative, we'll call it, creativity or not. How might you take this moment that many years ago and allow it to work for you? It can work for you in your attempt to find positivity in your life, or in storytelling, or just memory is so important. And I think part of the gift that I have in being able to move this career forward is having these vivid memories and being able to utilize them in my work.
You did a wonderful job with Peep Show, because it brings the real sense of feeling of being there. In some ways, you're living the life of David, your main character.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, because one of the things that sometimes I ask about, and this is something I thought about asking you, is that do writers sometimes tend to live their fantasy in the novels?
Yeah, well, I think, how would I answer that?
In a good way, now, okay? I mean, it's not some sort of an obscure.
Think about an actor who, the actor grew up and has a normal life, there wasn't any trauma or anything, but the actor has range, has a great deal of range within them. And so, like a De Niro, who grew up with autistic parents in New York, but he was sort of a brooding kind of guy, but he grew up and he can click into a more violent person than he is, or a more sensitive person than he is. He can play a doctor, he can play a criminal. So I think that some of that comes through when you're a writer, and it's very freeing to be able to say, even let's say it's not, that character's not even going to work, but I'm going to go write this dangerous character.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, for those moments, I'm going to try to get into that person's skin, and I think that can be healthy for people and cathartic for people. I've always admired people who can write and in other people's voices. And it reminds me of the fact that tonight I've actually recently taken a job teaching in the graduate program at the school that I graduated from, and tonight we're starting a book called The End of Alice, where we dissect books and we talk about texture and dialogue and character, and these are people who are pretty serious writers to be writers. They are writers. They want to publish, and we're reading a book tonight, or discussing it, called The End of Alice by an author named A.M. Holmes, and this woman, she's a woman who lives in New York, the author. And I met her not too long ago. Coincidentally, I had made my syllabus, and then I bumped into her, and I was able to tell her. But here she is, she's probably 5'2", and has a nice, sweet face, and this book is so scary about a criminal. And so the notion is, here's this nice little woman, and she is so talented that she takes you on this journey of people you'd never want to meet. And so I was reminded of it from your question, that there is great power in distancing yourself from your normal life and wearing the pants of somebody who's not you.
Well, what would you like to have your readers get out of reading your books?
I guess on that, I see them as, it's like a ride, you know, like a really good film feels like a ride. And at times there's going to be laughs, and at times there's going to be pathos, and the recognition of how relationships form and how people talk, and I think that's what's happening with my work. When you open the book, you're pretty quickly in, and I want pages to be moving, and I don't want anything to be too clunky, and I don't want anything to be too dense in the name of me showing everyone that I'm an artist. I want the ride to move. And then I found in a lot of the things I write, short stories, novels, and I write a blog on my website that's nonfiction, it has staying power, you know. When people are done, they have one feeling, and then in a couple of days, it germinates, and that's always a really great compliment. Like, wow, I've been thinking about your book a lot, and with Jacob Green, I would find myself in a round table with 15 women, and because they'd read the book, they felt close enough to me to say, well, you know what, my husband's a narcissist, and he's not so great with my kids. I wish he was, I would sit there and listen and be a little bit amazed at the fact that I'd just flown in from wherever and people were opening up to me. So there's power in it, and people feel connected, and it's not cheap writing, you know, it's not fluff, in the sense, it's not genre. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with genre,
right?
It's supposed to be literature, but it's not supposed to take you. You know, it's not Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with Faulkner, but I'm not trying to trick anybody. I want you to be on the journey.
So now, after two novels, how would you describe your underlying style and theme?
Oh, okay. I'm always going to be someone who's going to want to jump around and not be stuck in a genre like, you know, he writes about Jews. He's a Jewish writer. You know, I don't see myself that way. I obviously grew up religious and utilize that stuff. So I'm a writer of the human condition, and it's always going to be about relationships no matter what I write, and the intricacies of familial life is endlessly fascinating. Every topic is there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, love and want and desire of who you're going to become. My short stories before I published novels were about precocious kids who were unheard by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So the parents have a sense that they have it all going on, but the parents, there's a certain amount of selfishness, even though the family setting is not awful. It's not abuse, but there's distance from what's being said to one another. And the protagonist, the kid, is almost telling the reader that they understand what's going on way better than the parent. So I think that may have come from my early life, in the sense that I think I had a ton going on in my head while I was learning, you know, in this school that was not a very good school. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It doesn't even exist anymore, this school. half the day secular studies, half the day Judaic and Torah studies. So I think it was a bad match for me as a kid. and how I'm dealing with that in some sense is to be able to write about it and to call certain things out, not to punish anyone who's doing it or anyone who wrote it or anyone who believes it, but for myself to be able to figure things out. So I think that's where I come from. The first thing I would say is that I write about relationships. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel that having written these two novels has made you a better parent in some ways?
I work hard on being a good parent, and I think that they have helped in the sense that I have been able to be successful at the job that I dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
I am a person who had a dream of accomplishing something, and that came true. So in that sense, a person who is satiated in their goals, I don't have to think about me. I can think about them to a certain extent, right? If you have a person
mm-hmm.
who's hating getting up every morning and heading to a job and comes home and they're tired and they're disenchanted, it has to be harder to be a parent. Because being a parent is about, you know, I come home and it's about their day. And in time, hopefully my kids will ask me about my day. But they're 10 and 7. If you're waiting around waiting for them to ask about your day, it may be a long night. So, I work on being a good parent, and I do think that my work helps in that I get to do what I want to do with my days because
mm-hmm.
I worked hard to get to this spot. Of course, I have to go write another good book,
mm-hmm.
you know, to keep it going. But yes, I love being a parent, and I work on it, and I try to. And if there were things that I was raised, if my parents did things that were questionable in
right.
as far as parenting, you know, I try to veer from those, and I definitely take the good things that they gave me. And sometimes I fail. We all do.
I understand that. How about doing research, especially for the Peep Show? Has it strengthened your faith from a perspective of, I guess, religion in this case, strengthening your faith?
My research? My faith has not strengthened, but I'm not bitter. That's good.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not... We do not have a Christmas tree. I'll start there. We have a menorah at Hanukkah, and...
Mm-hmm.
At Passover, we have a Seder, and we have fun with it. And Judaism is, there's a couple of things to take away. One is the Jewish people have survived longer than any other people because it's just a fascinating truth.
Mm-hmm.
There's been millions of times, millions, well, over the centuries, there's been so much trouble for the Jewish people, but they never dwindled away to nothing. There was tons of attempts to make them into history and turn it into blah, blah, you know, nothing. And it's an amazing, resilient story, and I'm proud of being a part of that. My kids do not go to Hebrew school. I do not think there will be bar mitzvahs, which were major in my life, and
mm-hmm.
the build-up of the bar mitzvah and the reading Hebrew. We have wonderful cultural things. You can sort of be a cultural Jew if I can find
mm-hmm.
a spot for myself, and that is all these wonderful smells around the holidays and this food and some of the stories, and we keep it pretty light around here, but we don't celebrate Easter or Christmas or
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the family is concerned, how about your parents? Are they where are they at with regards to your writings about I guess the Jewish community in some way.
Yeah, I had a little trouble from my dad in that. In my first book, I told some truths that he didn't necessarily want people to hear, and then I went on the road and I talked about it, and a lot of times he was in the crowd, and he's a very open guy, and he's a smart man, and he's he had some friends who read it that he admired, you know, trusts and their minds, and they said, this is a very complex book, and there's a lot going on here. He started to come around a little more, and he and I got into conversations from it that led us to a better relationship than I've ever had. It sounds like
mm-hmm.
a Hollywood movie, you know, that ends
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
but it really is. He's 76 years old, and he and I have a great, great relationship, a little bit more like peers, I like to think, than...
Mm-hmm.
And the old father and son thing, because there were days back in the day where there was the power imbalance was not working,
mm-hmm.
And it took a long time to get free of that. But so this book was helpful in our catharsis. My next book didn't touch on anything close to that close in my personal life. So it was a real treat to be like, oh, you're happy? Okay, good. Yeah, everybody's happy. Because sometimes when I go in there and I'm writing and I'm hitting it hard and I'm by myself for the second year in a row, I decide to worry about consequence later. And that kind of happened with the first book in the sense that I said, yeah, my parents had sort of an ugly breakup, and we had religion crammed down our throat, and and those were truths.
How about your mom?
Mom, like in my first book, Mom converted to Judaism. So Mom was Protestant, New England Protestant, who met my Jewish dad, and she converted to Judaism before their marriage. So biologically, I'm half, and strangely enough, my wife's mom did the same thing. She was an Indiana farm girl and met a Jewish guy from New Jersey, just like my mom did, and she converted. So, for, you know, percentage-wise, I think my kids are—I don't know—I'm not very good at math, but we're mutts, you know, we're major mutts, but we are Jews. And Mom is very cool about all of it. She never got upset about Jacob Green. I remember getting a giant hug. And she's the one who taught me to read. She's the one who handed me books in the genre that I would end up writing in, and you know, caring about short stories. And I have a very supportive family, and as you know, probably we have other artists in our family.
Wonderful. Well, where can someone buy your book and get information about you as well as your latest happenings?
Okay. The book can be bought in any bookstore, I would hope. And if it isn't, it's certainly available on Amazon and all those channels. I have a website. It's joshuabrass.com. My name, two F's in Brass, and there you can see my tour schedule. I've had quite a busy summer on the road, and I have more events coming up. And I'm currently working on a new book, and really liking that. It's a little bit different in that I'm writing from the point of view of someone who is older, not than me, but older than my characters in other books, someone more my age. And what else can I share? I read a blog that's on the site. There's a lot of blog entries on my website. It's all nonfiction and sort of about my life or this happened to me and let's discuss that, or I'm on the road and this happened, and sometimes I write about my kids and what's going on with me. As far as being an author who sits down each day and tries to produce something, and so there's that kind of thing.
Do you have a quick advice for one novelist?
I missed, what kind of novelist?
Up and coming, who is interested in writing their first novel.
Yes, let's see. My advice would be to find your own voice. Finding your own voice as a writer can be done by writing a ton, and you'll see it come on its own. It doesn't happen for everybody. Mm-hmm. Reading a lot of the stuff that you liken yourself to. What kind of authors do you enjoy? And then when you do, and write a ton. So don't just write a sentence and, oh, this is going to be in there. Write a ton. You write, and then sometimes you throw things away. You write, and sometimes you keep the things that you feel are working. We used to do a free write exercise where you actually time yourself. Give yourself 5 minutes and a topic, like just any topic. You can follow the topic, or you can follow whatever story you're working on. And I would say go, and then keep your pen on the paper. Even if you have nothing to write, write blah, blah, blah. And write for until that timer goes off, and then if you're with someone else, read what you wrote, and then have no judgment between you. It's just an exercise. I'll be starting my class tonight with 15 people by doing that. It's really for you, and it's the sport of it. It's kind of exercising that part of your creative brain that needs to be honed.
Mm-hmm.
So. Practicing, and then when you feel like you've really got it going on and you've got a story going that you love, have other people that you trust read it. Get it into a perfect spot, but don't make it too perfect. You can hurt a story by trying to perfect it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would send it off to literary magazines, and I was rejected. Anybody who's going to get acceptances from these places, you get rejected a ton of times, and you're sort of in it, and then you realize, you know, if you're thrown off the horse – are you a person who's going to get on that horse or not? I was a person who kept getting back on, even though there was pain in being rejected, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like anything, if you fight and you're still driven, then you'll find yourself there. But, you know, finding your own unique voice is crucial because you don't want to sound like somebody else.
Well, by the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living would you like to share with our listeners this morning?
A recipe for living. Well, I don't know what other people have said in this slot, mm-hmm. So I'm just going to think about how I keep myself and my family in a good spot, and I think that has to do with all the things that I'm going to say are going to sound sort of trite and heard before, but we listen to each other. And that's crucial. And we spend time together as a family. And we have tons of eye contact, and we talk about how much we love each other, and we're not afraid to hold each other. We've learned, the four of us, from the beginning of as we've evolved, that there's nothing to be embarrassed about in front of each other. Families are messy, and at times, and we are in a position to be able to field any of that. Sometimes it's all going to fall apart, and sometimes, you know, find yourself, you're literally standing in the front hallway with the lunches made and everything, and you're sort of yelling at each other. But I remember Ram Dass writing in the book Be Here Now. He said, one time we were with friends, and the baby was crying, and everything was just going wrong, but it was about that moment. And to turn that moment around really doesn't take all that much time. It's almost as if, hey, let's find another channel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how are we going to find another channel? I don't know. Let's just stand here and not talk for a second. And it's not that hard to find that other channel where things are flowing. But so raising kids and being in a long-term marriage, there's all sorts of lessons. And ultimately it comes down to being good to yourself and allowing yourself to make mistakes. But getting yourself back on track quickly. So I don't know if that's a recipe for living.
It is. No, very, very much.
I did well? Oh, good.
Yes, you did very well. Well, okay. Joshua, thank you for the great recipes for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Anthony Morrison. He is the winner of Bravo's Sheer Genius Season 1 and a celebrity hairstylist and hair makeover artist on TLC's 10 Years Younger. Anthony and I will be discussing his life's journey and the launch of his new product line, Anthony Morrison Collection Hair Care Products. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/FMMK Talk Radio. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Joshua, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you so much, Johnny.
Thank you.